You're listening to a program produced in 2016 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. So tonight we have the truly great pleasure of hearing two amazing poets, Sharon Olds and Robin Kos Lewis, read from their intimate work that, among other qualities and intentions and effects, interrogates the structure of the body through its pleasures and sorrows, complex aesthetics, and universal truths. Sharon Olds is the recipient of both the Pulitzer Prize and England's T.S. Eliot Prize for her 2012 collection, Stag's Leap. She's the author of 10 previous books of poetry and the winner of many other awards and honors. She teaches in the Graduate Creative Writing Program at NYU and helped found the NYU Outreach Program, among them the writing workshops for residents of Goldwater Hospital on Roosevelt Island and for veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. In her remarkable new collection, Odes, she sings in praise of things that are not often considered worthy of appreciation and reconsiders others that are. You'll soon hear them for yourself, but I've been reading these poems aloud to friends for the last several months, taking note of their astonishment and delight as they consider menstrual blood, condoms, unmatched legs, and other remarkable things. Robin Kos Lewis is the author of Voyage of the Sable Venus, her first book, which won a National Book Award. In the citation for that award, the judges wrote, Robin Kos Lewis's Voyage of the Sable Venus is a meditation on the cultural depiction of the black female figure, juxtaposing autobiography with art historical constructs of racial identity, she defines and creates self. The thrilling centerpiece of Robin's book is its 79-page title poem, which consists almost entirely of the titles of Western artworks spread over some 40,000 years, which comment on the black female figure. Robin's a provost fellow in poetry and visual studies at USC. She's also a Cave Canem fellow and a fellow of the LA Institute for Humanities. She grew up right here in Compton, California, went to Hampshire College, got her MFA from NYU, and an MTS in Sanskrit and Comparative Religious Literature from Harvard. We first heard Robin here on the stage, on the Aloud stage, several years ago in our tribute to Wanda Coleman, another great Los Angeles poet, whom she honored with a memorable homage and her steady, tender, brave voice. We're going to welcome both of our poets. We'll start with Robin Kos Lewis.
Thank you, dear.
Is that a surprise? Louise said that she had a surprise, and I think that was just it, one of the Venuses. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you all for coming. Can you guys hear me okay? Not so well. It's not that mic. It's this mic. It's okay. Thank you, though. Better now? Yes? No? We're okay? Okay, great. So I'm really, really, really grateful to be here because this is the Los Angeles Public Library. And as Louise said, I was born in Compton, and I have a very strong fondness for this place as a site of refuge and a site of incredible imagination and creativity. So it's always important and significant for me to be here. And also, as Louise said, and she doesn't know this, the first time I read here, it was for the Wanda Coleman Memorial. And so I thought that I would read the poem of Wanda Coleman's that I read that day because it is about this library. But I also thought I would read it because Wanda Coleman, Lucille Clifton, Sharon Olds, Toni Kate Bambara, Toni Morrison, Fannie Howe, Alicia Ostreicher, we can just go on and on. It would be such a great thing if we made a poem of their names, change the culture of American literature. And I had the incredible honor when I went to NYU of being Sharon's student. And in fact, the title poem that Louise was just talking about, I wrote under Sharon's tutelage, and it was a profound experience. So I thought I would read Wanda Coleman for you, Sharon. This is poem number 7, and it's from Dreamwalk, her series of poems called Dreamwalk, from Bathwater Wine, number 7. Fear drives you to tears and out of the house during arguments with mama for long walks on sweltering summer eves. The moths come, collect on grainy stucco porches, are hosed away at sunrise. You stare at shaded windows, struggle to decipher the lives inside. Who are they? Do they see you out here watching? Won't some sympathetic someone invite you in for tea? Cars are being washed in turtle wax by loving hands. Preteeners play dodgeball on vacant lots. The librarian admonishes you for staying so late and not having brought your card. Palms nod against the neon rainbow. The moths come, and the starlings, and the dragonflies. You know something important is going to happen to you. Hurry, you whisper. Please, hurry. And since I was born in California and Sharon was born in California, I thought I'd read some poems about California. And I thought I'd also use that decision as an opportunity to talk to you about Aloud's podcasts and videos, because I'm not going to read any poems from Voyage. But if you look at the Aloud podcast series, and this is also a way to celebrate Maggie Nelson and Claudia Rankin, there's a video of us in a reading together here and a conversation afterwards online, Where Am I In Reading, the title poem. And also, it's just a fantastic conversation. And Claudia and Maggie just won the MacArthur, so it's like a triple dip, okay? So you can look on Aloud's website. It's fantastic. I read some poems about Los Angeles, and I'm going to start with second line. For Henry Gabriel Lewis, my father, and for Henri Raphael Lewis, my son. Second line. And then one day, you fell and broke your neck, just like that, while taking a shower. Afterward, you walked back to your chair and asked about the length and color of the weather lady's skirt. It was brown. When the ambulance arrived, you told them, "Go on home." You were fine. 2 hours later, you slumped over, and still it took them 3 more days to realize you'd severed your spine, because the whole time you told jokes and wouldn't quit smiling. Pull my finger. Stoic and stolen so early on, what is it about veterans of the Second World War that makes death require more convincing? 3 months in ICU, a broken neck, 3 bouts of a pneumonia, 8 heart attacks, a clement stream of steady infections, and yet, there you were, still 84, in a coma, batting your eyelashes nonstop and full speed at the world. Even while dying, you would not die, so we were forced to kill you. But then we put on Ray Charles, and just when they pulled the plug, he began your favorite song, "Hit the Road, Jack." Which you did. You hit it. Before the song could end, you were gone. I've never been so proud as I was that morning, watching your breath, second line home, so quietly. Except for that day when I first started my period and was ashamed. Nobody would go and buy me anything because they said it all came with the new messy territory. But you drove me right up to the store, said, "Stay in the car," then came back out with the paper bag. When you fell, it was the first month of spring, March 13th. That day, I climbed into the air and could not climb back down until now. So how do you call that body born colored and male? Hunted and used for cog and prey. Tree adornment, altar cloth, war fodder. And still somehow came laughter often and more eagerly than fear. Your one half good eye forever fixed and cocked on the wry glint of the world. When I was 4, you showed me how to play tonk and the proper way to throw down a bone and score with sound. When kindergarten began, they had to skip me 2 grades because you had already taught me when and how to double down. That's what it felt like to be Negro me, daughter of colored janitor you. Pie was not a pastry. History was not a book. It was a smell like damp cinnamon in your blue work shirt. Starched pans, union, crawdad, crab boil, oysters shucked and soaking in their primordial liqueur. It smelt like all of this, in the Vieux Carré, its thick, peculiar cotton air breaking beneath the sea's sloppy canopy. It smelt like the last high note of the market woman's song, sing song, whenever she cried, fresh strawberries. History was the smell of dirty whites, soaking in a hot tub of bleach, and your first whore, that nice girl from Storyvale, who Unc Felix took you to see when you were a randy gentleman all of 14. History was the morning of your first communion, marbles and cigarettes pocketed inside your muslin altar boy gown. It was the smell of gunpowder from the small pistol you hid in your sock to protect your brother Lucian and other Negro doctor friends while they tended the colored, sick, and shut-in. It smelled like a palmetto tree, like every tree, red with sap, warm with wonder, and holy things which are common and plain, a brown paper bag, okra by the crate, the ironing board when left in a room to cool, my pencil you sharpened with your switchblade each morning just before I left for school. I sensed all these things, the country you'd seen, but I had never been. I could smell the world all over you. You gave it to me, a fresh, sharp walnut, pungent and coy. You cracked it, plucked out its intelligence, then dropped it in my hand, this deep, black joy. Thank you. Art and craft. I would figure out all the right answers first and gently mark a few of them wrong. If a quiz had 10 problems, I'd cancel out one. When it had 20, I'd bite my tongue, then leave at least 2 questions blank. A B was good, but an A was too good. They'd kick your ass, call your big sister slow, then stare over your desk as if you'd snaked out of a different hole. Knowing taught me quickly to spell community more honestly. L-O-N-E-L-Y. During arts and crafts, when Miss Larson allowed the scissors out, I'd sneak a pair, then cut my hair to stop me from growing too long. Thank you. The body in August. Because when I was a child, God would pull me up into her lap. Because when she pulled me up into her lap, she would read to me. Because the story she read most was the one I liked least. Because every day she'd open that thin green book and say, "This is the story of your life." Because from beginning to end, there were only 3 pages. I believe in that road that is infinite and black and goes on blindly forever. I believe crocodiles swallow rocks to help them digest crab, because up until the 20th century, people could still die from sensation. And because my hunger is so deep, I am ashamed to lift my head. Because memory, not gravity, pins us to this trembling, and when God first laid eyes on us, she went mad from envy. Because if the planet had a back door, we'd all still be there waiting for the air to approve our entry. Because your eyes were the only time the peonies said yes to me. Because no matter how many times I died, I always woke up again happy. Then last night, after I yelled at him for the first time, my new son dreamt we went walking inside the trees. When we came across a squirrel, he said, I'd kicked it. Then the squirrel changed into a thin green book, which we read. Because when God became a small child, I pulled her up into my lap. Because when I pulled her into my lap to please her, I opened my blouse. because her mouth is an impossibly pink place, a gaping raw cathedral which she opened teeth to nipple, then clamped down. Thank you. Mother Church number 3, King Kletso, Yellow House, Chaco Canyon, San Juan County, New Mexico, Anasazi Ruins, AD 1125 to 1130, for Henri Attu. You step down into the flat world, then ask me to say it, to explain how our name can mean both ancestor and enemy. Your body begins in 4 directions. Here, 1 calendar takes 18 years. I am 3. 1 day is an eyelash. Your body is a segment of prehistoric road, a buried stairwell with only the top stair obvious. We are alluvial, obsidian. Sometimes the ground swells with disappointment. Sometimes we know our mountains will be renamed after foreign saints. We sing 900-year-old hymns that instruct us in how to sit still for 49 years through a 50-year drought. We climb down through the hole anyway and agree to the arrangement. Thank you. There's a story behind this poem that I love to tell, but I don't have time. So maybe later during Q&A or some other point, ask me. It has nothing to do with the poem, and I love that. But I think it's why I wrote the poem. But this poem is called Verga. And Verga in Italian and in some places in Spanish has the incredible double meaning of meaning both rod or stick and virgin. Go figure. There is an epitaph from Abshiru Adin Muhammad, who was in the Dagaheli Somali refugee camp in the year 2000. Here's the epigraph. Quote, "Women don't want the men to go into the bush because the women will only be raped, but the men will be killed. I have seen a woman who was caught in the bush by several men. They tied her legs to 2 trees while she was standing. They raped her many times, and before leaving her, they put stones in her vagina. Verga. Before leaving her, they put stones in her vagina. The men will only be raped, but the stones will be killed. The bush caught many men to go into the stones. The stones will be killed by several trees before leaving. The bush tied the men to the trees in their vaginas. Before bush go to trees, they kill many stones. Many men will be caught by the trees in the bush. Several trees will be raped by the bush and then killed. Only the caught men will be stoned and bushed by the trees. Several men were caught by the trees before leaving. The men will be killed, but the stones will only be treed. The stones put many trees into the men's killed vaginas. By the bush, the trees were raped only several times. Before leaving, the vaginas were seen standing in the stones." And then I'll just read 2 more. This is The Wild Woman of Aiken. In 1882, Oscar Wilde toured the United States, and before he got off of his ship, he was met with an incredible visual, I don't know even what to call it, but they basically just skinned him in the media. And the way that they skinned him was by representing, they interpreted his femininity and their homophobia racially, which is to say that they represented him as monkeys, as African men, as African dandies. And there was one photographer who I'm writing about now, J.A. Palmer, who took it all the way and represented him as a black woman in a photograph that is exceptionally beautiful. It's in the Steve Turner collection. Steve Turner, who is a gallery owner here in L.A. And so this photograph, there's a beautiful woman sitting in it, but she's supposed to be Oscar Wilde, but she's a beautiful black woman. And so there's all these inversions and folding in. And of course, because it's photography, his mission, J.L. Palmer's mission backfired. The photograph is beautiful, and the photograph remains in J.L. Palmer's dust. So I like to read it. This is The Wild Woman of Aiken, based on the photograph by J.A. Palmer, album and photograph in Orange Mount. I am not supposed to be beautiful. I am not supposed to sit before the observant eye of a sunflower. I am incapable of having a voice like a robin's singing of springtime's newborn impatience, its balsams and touch-me-nots crouched so low to the ground. Vases and I are not permitted to dally. If I were a name, it would be wallpaper. My hair is made of a million breathing paisleys. For 5,000 years, I've listened to you think aloud about a world that does not exist. I am sitting here in the open, and you are there dripping beneath your dark velvet, waiting for the light to reach you. I have wondered where you really live. Why you cannot hear all the glass inside your syllables slide off the table whenever your mouth opens and is then closed. The story has not even begun. The only thing left inside my hand is my own quiet hand. I am the fourth sister. My florets stand together at golden angles. My head is packed with eager seeds crisscrossing in spirals 100 garlands long. It's over now. About my waist, dark and bright, there is this satin sash, the color of sun-warmed eggplant, still fetching on the vine. You cannot prevent me. Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm going to end with a poem that's not mine as well, but a person that was exceptionally special to Sharon and exceptionally special to American literature and feminist literature, Lucille Clifton. This is A Dream of Foxes. And it's in my book because at the end, in the acknowledgments, I wanted to thank all of my friends and family for helping me to live my life more than write a book. And I wanted to read it for you to thank you for being here. A Dream of Foxes. In the dream of foxes, there is a field and a procession of women clean as good children. No hollow in the world surrounded by dogs, no fur-clumped bloody on the ground. Only a lovely line of honest women stepping without fear or guilt or shame, safe through the generous fields. Lucille Clifton, thank you.
Thank you, babe.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank
you. Oh, I forgot. Yes, I did. Oh, Robin, I could just listen to you and listen to you and listen to you. What a wonderful voice, heart, mind this morning. I'm being kindly put up. Thank you, Louise, and all, right across the street. So I look out the window, and there is the hat of the LA Public Library, the mosaic tile, beautiful pyramid hat, which I love. And then I was thinking about tonight, and I looked and saw the moon, a waning crescent moon in the sky. Thought about Robin, thought about women, thought about sacredness, and thought about heavenly bodies, which are often used for purposes of navigation. So I thought about the voyage of the Sable Venus and said to Robin there at my window, "Oh, Captain, my Captain." I am so happy to be here. Looking forward to our conversation. And I'm going to jump right in and read a few odes. Ode to the clitoris. Can you hear me? Yeah. Ode to the clitoris. Little eagerness. Flower girl basket of soft thorn and petal near the entry of the satin column of the inner aisle. Scout in the wilderness. Wild ear which perks up, tender dowser which points, imp, shapeshifter, bench-pressing biceps of a teeny goddess who is buff, lotus for grief, wheatsy Minerva who springs full-armored, molten, I did not know you at seven. I thought you were God's way of addressing me, when I kept swinging on the rings after the bell had rung. He didn't use his words, he used you to get my attention. He wrenched me and wrenched me then in six or seven wrenches of my body and brain, you, the living wrench which winched the wrenches. Later, you would do that without God, with boys, with kisses, and later you'd become an instrument of love's music. Today, I saw your portrait for the first time, your dorsal vein, your artery, your cavernous body, your vestibular bulb, your suspensory ligament, and I could see how evolution got the idea from you to invent an organ, something like you, but a lot bigger. You were named for a Greek hill, clinine, a slope. You are the ground of our being, the tiny figure of the human, the hooded stranger who comes to the door, and if we bless her, we will be blessed. When I was first writing these poems, they were just coming to me on their own. I'm not saying I didn't want them to come to me, but somehow they were making their way to me on their own. I didn't think of doing a book of them. I usually am ashamed of my obsessions and kind of thrilled with them at the same time. But I think of this is, you know, if it's supposed to be literature, I should disguise them and maybe have just a little section of odes in a book. But I ended up not wanting to do that. And here I am in L.A., so I'm just jumping right in. So following that first one comes the second one. Ode to the penis. Someone told me that what I write about men is objectifying. So I ask you, O general idea of the penis, do you mind being noticed? You who stand in the mind, erect and not, old and young, for all your representations, O abstract principle, haven't you maybe been waiting for your turn to be praised? I think you're lovely and brave and so interesting. You are like a creature with your head and trunk as if you have a life of your own. But you are innocent. You are not your own man. You are no more responsible for your actions than the matter of the brain for its thoughts. And you've had a mixed history. You've been taken into carnage as the instrument of it, and you yourself have been played to produce the desperate screams. Often you have not been protected, nor used to protect, and oft not been respected, nor wielded to respect. And yet most of your history has been spent in joy. And I wonder how it has felt being so adored as you have been and feared, and what it is like for you if you look down from your platonic cloud of categories when two of you are engaged together or married, yourself primed, yourself to your own power. And being a concept, are you smart? Do you know you're equal to your sister concept, and even that you came from her back at the invention of the separate male, the ovaries heavying down toward the earth, the organ of orgasm growing and growing? I cannot imagine you from within, but as a sage said of a god, I do not want to be sugar, I want to taste sugar. But that's just my heteromania talking. And you're not homo or hetero or visible or manifest. You do not exist except as an imaginary quorum of all your instances. So I'm not flirting with you. I'm just saying I like you. Not as an object, but a subject, a prime mover, a working theory of plumbing and ecstasy, a boy's pride and anxiety, wind sock of zephyr and gale, half of the equation of creation. When I found I was writing a lot of odes, I didn't look up ode because I was afraid that I wasn't really writing odes. And I really liked the idea that I was writing odes, so I'm still not sure what one is. But I found that my general tendency to stick with the concrete and specific was encouraged by my wish to write odes to go more abstract. So that was very exciting to me when that, for me, kind of new dimension came into my poems. And by your kind request, my love, I'll read this one as well. When Evie Shockley's book, The New Black, came out a few years ago, it became a favorite of mine, and the poem, I'm thinking of it as Ode to My Blackness, or Poem to My Blackness, but that poem of Evie's is what inspired this poem. Ode to My Whiteness. You were invisible to me. You went without saying. You were my weapon, secret from myself. Whatever I got, you helped get it for me. You were my ignorance. Because of you, I was not innocent. I did not see that. You were my blinding light. My dreams had a blank area in the center, taking up most of the screen they played on in my sleep, a blazing circle that blanked out the core of the scene. I thought it was my mother's violence, but it was you, too. You, the unseen fat which fed me in the wilderness. You, my Masonic handshake. You, my stealth. You, my drone. You, my collaborator. You, my magician's cloak of steam. You, my dissembler. You, mine. I, yours. Irisless eyeball. You, my blindness, inspiration of my helpless act. You, my silence. Evie's blackness, a dancer. You, another. The two of you moving together. Amaryllis Ode. When the blossoms were wilting, I cut the stalk and put it in a glass before my trip to have waiting for me the damp, withering blooms to see when I came back. I thought of the female side of my genealogy, the mothers, who have liked to have waiting upstairs a daughter stripped to be punished. And I realized I had been my mother's conduit to the satisfaction of being in her own time the beater. I think she did not know what she was doing. And it is nice, isn't it, to have something waiting, the knowledge of which will thrill you. How much drier will the blossoms be? How averted each pistil tip on its coral stalk, dusted with ochre seed. My mother and I were a twosome, as her mother and she had been, and her mother's mother. Mine used to perform a tune, not while she was beating on me. White coral bells upon a silver stalk. It was a pleasure for me to be head, the amaryllis, to slit its throat. The last verse was, oh, don't you wish that you could hear them ring? That will happen only when the fairies sing. Or in our case, when the dead mothers weep. My mother would weep to read this. And I'll read two more. And this one was from January 2010. And so some of the friends of the title, which is Ode to My Living Friends, some of the friends in 2010 included Miss Lucille and Galway and Phil and C.K. Williams and C.D. Wright and Mark Strand and so many, many more. Ode to My Living Friends, January 2010. What a lengthy gap there has been between deaths. It seems as if none of those closest to us has gone for what seems months. For me, it's been so long that when I think of someone dying, I think of my mother and father, my farriers in out of nothing, out of the temporary rich something they were made of. I have carried them with me, not like a partial twin in a sling in front of and against me, but in my body, in my brain cells. But you, my friends, my chosen and chosen by ones, I see you as built-in aspects of the earth, like elements, like members of the periodic table. I know we're mortal. The open door is there. But for weeks and weeks, I have forgotten that I'm going to lose every one of you until the ones who are left lose me. When I was a child, I could not have lost you. I did not know that I would find you. I'm blessed that it will happen to me. Before it does, let me say, you were exactly who I'd been looking for without daring to imagine. Breast that presses against other breasts, it was you. Root of washed sweet flag, timorous pond snipe, nest of guarded duplicate eggs, it was you. Hands I have taken, face I have kissed, mortal I have ever touched, it was you. So, that's for all of you. That's for you. And I'll close this part, and then we'll come and have our conversation together with this poem, which is the turned out to be the opening poem in this book, which was like born yesterday, approximately. Thank you, thank you. Ode to the Hymen. I don't know when you came into being inside me, when I was inside my mother. Maybe when the involuntary muscles were setting like rose jello. I love to think of you then, so whole, so impervious, you and the clitoris as safe as the lives in which you were housed. They would have had to kill both my mother and me to get at either of you. I love her at this moment as the big fortress around me, the matron head around the sweetmeat of my maidenhead. I don't know who invented you to keep a girl's inwards clean and well-cupboarded. Dear wall, dear gate, dear style, dear Dutch door, not a cat flap nor a swinging door, but a one-time pinata. How many places in the body were made to be destroyed once? You were very sturdy, weren't you? You took your job seriously. I'd never felt such pain. You were the hourglass lady the magician saws in two. I was proud of you, turning to a cupful of the bright arterial ingredient. And how lucky we were, you and I, that we got to choose when and with whom and where and why, plush pincushion, somehow related to statues that wept. It happened on the rug of a borrowed living room, but I felt as if we were in Diana's woods, he and I and you together, or as if we were where the magma from the core of the earth burst up through the floor of the sea. Thank you for your life and death. Thank you for your flower girl walk before me, throwing down your scarlet petals. It would be years before I married, years before I carried within me a tiny baby hymen, near its eggs with other teensy hymens within them. But you unscrolled the carpet, leading me into the animal life of a woman. You were a sort of blood mother to me. First you held me close for 18 years, and then you let me go. Thank you.
I'm going to have you. How about this one? Russell, can you bring up that? There she is. I wanted you both. This was my thank you for this beautiful reading. She was blessing us today because I thought it was a great omen because this was just found in Turkey. It's a rare stone figurine of a woman about 8,000 years old. Sorry. And she was found beneath a platform with a piece of obsidian. And they think it was placed there as a ritual, but they think that she's represents older women who have achieved status. So I thought this was a wonderful blessing
on the poems and the O's.
Is she touching her breast, too? Yeah. I think she's touching her breast.
That's one way to have status. Yeah. In internal, inner sense of well-being.
Exactly.
Thank you both for these magnificent works, these beautiful books. Wasn't that a fantastic reading? Fantastic. It's such a sensual experience reading these poems that even though I have been reading them for many weeks, when I open the book again, I feel like each time I'm reading them for the first time, which is because there's so much to discover. So I thought I would just kind of throw out a few words that we could kind of explore in relation to them and that might have some relevance to your methodology and, you know, how you work. And one of them is the originality. And I came to it thinking I was reading this lovely essay by Charles Simic, who says, "Where does originality in poetry come from?" He says, "It comes from tinkering with some older poetic model. It comes from seeing its weaknesses along with its attractions. It comes from God knows what and only the devil knows. Some degree of irreverence is always involved. Kneeling before a masterpiece is not the way to go." And I thought you were both so experimental and so daring. Are there forms that you feel like you've been tinkering with? Obviously, the ode for you, but in Voyage of the Sable Venus, is there a roadmap? Was there a roadmap for either of you?
A formal roadmap.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think from reading... Well, first, before I say anything, I can't believe I was so stupid. The first thing at the top of my list was to say that Sharon Olds publishing a new collection is a literary event, and how excited I am about your new book being out. Mm-hmm. I meant to say that. Yeah.
Thank you, love.
And that Sharon and I have the same publisher and the same publicist, and our publicist sent me her galley this summer, and I just held it like I couldn't. So congratulations,
thank you,
and thank you so much for
giving us
more. I can't believe it. Do I have a formal path that I follow? I kind of do the very cliche thing I've heard everyone else do, is I try to follow the poem's motivation and listen to where the poem wants to go. I think the thing that is most hard is that often I don't want to go where the poem wants to go. And so then there's a whole kind of wrestling of aesthetics between me and me, I guess. Like, I didn't want to write a 79-page long poem made of titles. Who the hell would do that stupid shit? I didn't want to do that. But, you know, as I said, Sharon was my professor at the time, and it just kept going and going. And, you know, at any point, I thought it was going to be 3 pages, and it just, anyway. But with other poems, okay, go ahead.
Was there any formal model in the background of your mind when you first started doing Sable Venus?
Well, do you remember the first poem I did was Invocation, which was like this really, it's one of the first poems in the book movements, and it was musical. And I remember thinking a lot about Lucille and wanting, how do you make, I mean, you know, poetry is lyric, it's music, it's making, turning whatever language you use into a musical instrument. And I remember wanting it to sound liturgical, regardless of what the words were saying. I wanted it to have drums, like boom. So any titles I could find that had tonal sounds and things like that were interest me.
Also, as someone who studied Sanskrit, the epic was
absolutely
was in your mind.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Because
and then it moves across time into more contemporary or organic forms. But anyway.
Well, what it was for us was that we got to come there once a week and hear what had next been written in this amazing poem. We were right there.
Wow.
I think there were times when we said so. We looked at each other and said, "We're hearing it first." So it was. It was an amazing.
How long a period of time?
It was a semester.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd researched it for years, but it was a semester. And it was because Sharon was my teacher, and I was like, I mean, you heard her work, right? And you know her work. I before we started the semester, and I started, she was the first workshop I took at NYU in my MFA, and so I read all her work again the summer before we started, because you get more out of your teachers if you really know their work, I think. And I remember reading The Pope's Penis, which is a fantastically brilliant poem. And I remember writing a mutual friend, Elizabeth Alexander, the whole poem, going, look at her, look what she did. And Elizabeth goes, I know, she always scares you at the end. You know? And so I knew that I could try. I didn't know what was going to happen. I just knew that if ever there was a person I could try this with, it would be her.
And
so it was
amazing. I'm thinking of all the other amazing people who are around that table.
Oh, God, yes.
What a room.
So many many classmates, really talented poets. It was a very special moment.
And I would think about originality, that if you're blessed with a line that one day that you don't know where it came from, and I think that it has something to do with the fact that no one's ever going to see what you're writing. Mm. No one's ever going to know how dumb one can be. You're safe. You're just alone writing. And I think we develop a taste, some of us, for what's odd and what's weird and what's different about each of us, which are all the different things about each of us. So I would add that to what we've already said.
Well, I think it's been mentioned in a review or thinking of the idea of some of the places you've gone and the odes and the things that you've chosen or have come to you to write about, this other word, disgust. You know, what is of disgust? The feminist scholar Martha Nussbaum has called for, quote, an informal social movement akin to the feminist Our Bodies movement, a movement against self-disgust for the aging, which I thought was great. So she promotes Whitman's anti-disgust worldview, and she believes that a dread of the body's physical realities creates a threat to civic life. Mm. And I wondered if you would go so far as to agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
And why? And why? Why are we so afraid of talking about these parts of the body, do you think? Does it come from our religious upbringing?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure about... I was so happy writing the poems about the aging body. And yes, I would have felt that they were going against some trends in some of our cultures about youngness being by far the best thing, perhaps especially in women.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much I love about this new book, Sharon, but one of them is like the title and the form, or is an ancient form, or at least a medieval form, right? So, you know, and then, but your subject matter is not
right.
The subject matter that odes are traditionally about. And so there's this incredible abyss that opens, and it's both terrifying, again, Elizabeth's observation about your aesthetic, is it's fear, and yet it's delicious, right? You know? And about those very bodies and how our bodies change. And
because we're crossing over that abyss
history.
With you, right?
Right, exactly.
Right.
But also I like in the Ode to the Hymen poem how you also go backwards in the biology around, you know, so I don't know if you caught the biology in that last poem, but, you know, when there's a female fetus, she already has all the eggs that she will have in her body for her whole life. I mean, that's a profound, talk about packed with eager seed, that's a profound biological occurrence that happens. And I love that you have that included that in your poem.
Thank you.
I was also thinking when you were reading that beautiful poem of leaving friends, that in a way it reminded me of the Kaddish, because it's a poem about death that blesses life. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that was...
I love that, Louise. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Because I tried reading that to a dear friend the other day, and it's so powerful to say those words to a friend. Mm-hmm. It's quite an invocation. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm. That amazing poem. There's also poems in both of your books about the body's absence.
I feel like my back is to them.
The body's absence.
Sorry. I just really...
And I wondered if you could talk about that. You have that poem, Sharon, it's called Secondary Boycott Poem, with the lines, "I had never seen anyone saying no with their body, with their feet. When I stepped towards the circle, a man walked a little faster and a woman walked a little slower." And you, Robin, in your poem, Lure, describe a state of being which is also an absence of the body. And I wondered if you could talk about, I mean, that's such a, to write from the body as an absence of a body was just kind of mind-boggling to read. So
absolutely
fascinating.
Should I go first?
Go ahead.
One of my experiences of my own body and of observing other people's experiences of theirs is that we're often not in them. We leave them so regularly. Right. We rarely are present. We rarely inhabit them. I joke with friends, sometimes I feel like I'm only in the tip of my pinky. And it sometimes takes me a long time to get back in it. And that, to me, is a very common experience. It's not unusual, I don't think. It's especially not unusual within political and historical contexts where you're being, or one is being told one does not exist. I think we talked about that the last time I was here, how we have to will ourselves into history. And that also means, for me, willing myself into the body and really inhabiting it and really inhabiting the moment. And so in that poem, Lure, certainly, but in I think most of the poems in the book, it's about assisting upon an existence that isn't suspicious of life, you know, that at the very least insists upon embodiment as, I don't want to say a right, because it isn't political at first, but that is an arduous task, one of the first, you know, before we get anywhere. You know, Virginia Woolf used to talk about this in different ways. We're just memory and, you know, interactions with people and trying to really get down to the absolute kernel of intimacy with oneself and with each other as an excavation of history and political interaction for me. And that means, therefore, then there has to be a discussion of absence. Because for so many people, for so many places around the world and within this country, absence is one of the most present things in our lives. And so to ignore absence would be to ignore history completely.
It's a little like the upside down of that that has come to my mind, which is one of the things I love in your book is the texture and the many textures, the physicality, the many capital letters because of all the titles, and the richness and density of the and accuracy of all kinds of description in all of the poems in the two other parts.
Thank you.
So that sense of richness, fullness, intelligence, and effortless singing of it.
And there's shape-shifting in both of your work. I mean, the different bodies change. Who's inhabiting the body seems to move. I mean, Robin, you have that line, perhaps embodiment is so bewildering, even God goes rack with doubt. And I mean, the parts of the body speak, Sharon, in your odes, and it shifts, you know, who we're looking, which part of the body we're looking at and which perspective. So there's kind of an upside down, inside out quality to where we are in the body in both of your works. It's a very embodied feeling reading here. both of your works. You also talked, Sharon, about permission, which I thought was a kind of key word. When you have an ode, it's the Ode of Broken Loyalty. in which you talk about coming to the point where there was little I could not write about, that you'd broken a contract with your family, which freed you. And I wondered if maybe you could both, if you both ascribe to that feeling now that there was little that you could not write about, and if that came about through some kind, for you too, Robin, of a broken contract. That's such an interesting way to get to that freedom.
I'll just do my part quickly. Yeah. The way, as I remember, that poem ends is, as if one could be loyal, being loyal to the truth that is disloyal to the family. Mm. I meant that as if. Mm. That's a, yeah, so it wasn't all thinking that was such a good thing to do. I wanted a place to think about mm-hmm. broken loyalty and to call it that. Yeah, so that as if.
So the poem gives you the as if. The poem gives you...
Well, I think it ends on, like, as if I'm loyal. Not. But go ahead, love.
I love her so much. I can't think about it. Mm. If I think about it, I will never write. I will never write. Mm. I mean, I also think this is an issue of gender, too. I mean, we're so conditioned into silence. And I can't, you know, I forget, I don't remember where, I was in some conversation with someone in an interview. And, you know, I spend most of the hours of my day and most of my days of my life and most of the months of my year giving to something else and working for someone else and doing something for someone else and trying to please something else and in service of something else. And a great deal of that is by choice. I love it. I wouldn't have it any other way. But some of it is not. And, you know, I feel like there's very little I ask for but a piece of paper. And if on that piece of paper I can't do whatever the hell I want at any time in any way, then I might as well just, I mean, really, it's a piece of paper, right? It's just a piece of paper. That's one side of it. The flip side of it is I think about all the writers in the world who absolutely do not have the privilege that we have as American writers to write about hymens and clitorises and incest and penises, especially as women. Can you imagine? I mean, without being imprisoned or murdered.
Yes.
You know, there are wonderful advocacy organizations in the world for the rights of writers and artists, and we're just very lucky that we have American passports, and we can... My first poem in my book has a girl with a cock under her skirt, you know? I couldn't do that in certain countries as a writer, and so I better do it. As in, I'm going to write a poem. You know, that's not how... at all I write. I don't care. That's not my agenda. I know that's other people's agenda, and that's great. It's just not mine. But if the work that's asking to be written happens to have an ode to a hymen or a girl with a steel cock under her skirt, then that's what I'm putting on the page. And I'll just have to deal with the fallout later. My son is 8 now, and he read a poem, or he heard he Googled me in school. And I know. And he was so hurt. I mean, he was devastated because he misunderstood the poem. I mean, poetry is hard to translate English to English to English. So anyway, he misunderstood, and he thought there's a poem in there called Summer, and I say, and asked my son to stop with this incessant back chat. And then I said, and then I cursed God, his arrogance, his gall. And he thought I was talking about his arrogance, my son, and his gall. And he was devastated for like a week. And then he said, Mommy, I mean, sobbing, please, you cannot ever write about me again. And I was like, damn it, it starts this early. And, right? Right? And then, you know, he was in my bed and I was hugging him. And then I was like, and after he calmed down, I said, okay, I can never make that promise to you. I can't. That's what it means to be the son of an artist. And someday you might grow up to want to write about things that I want to approve of or do things that I want to approve of, and I'll try to support you in that. But I cannot make that promise. Loyal, as if I could be loyal. I can't. History trumps, history and politics trumps everything for me. And the work I'm trying to do as an artist, not on the page. In his life, sure, but not here. It's a book.
And Sharon, that's something that you've dealt with a lot as a mother and a poet, right?
Yes.
Whether you would...
If I admit it, I have kids. Yes. I was so anxious about ever speaking about actual family members, especially early on for me, especially...
And some poems you held on to, right? Till your children were older. I mean, was that a decision that you made? I mean, from Stag's Leap, you decided to hold it?
Yes. Well, that was a book that, you know, in the lines in heaven or wherever it is, in where they're lining up to get conceived, the line that says autobiographical writer as a mother, there's no one in that line. No one in that line. And so I had to work out my stuff in relation to parents and my stuff in relation to children. And I So I was actually asked by one of my children to not, at the age of 8, just that was enough. This is a long time ago, but I thought she was right. Oh, wait, one of my children. I thought they were right. I thought that was right. To write the poems, yes. But it at that point seemed fair to me. This is a long time ago. And it's, you know, for each one of us, it's such a different thing.
I'm about to open up to questions, but I wanted to end with, this question, because you read the poem "Ode to My Whiteness," and I know that Robin, you were quoted in an interview. Someone said to you about "Voyage of the Sable Venus." It's so sad what your book exposes about what's been done to Black women, and you said, "No, what it exposes is white pathology." And I wonder, it's just interesting hearing this, and have you two talked about Sharon's poem, and have you, in terms of how what's its effect on you, or what's it like hearing it, and it was such an interesting thing to
write
about.
I remember the first time, I want to back up just a little bit and say, it's deeply ironic and coincidental that your early work about your children and your early work about your body is what has given so many writers of all genders, I don't want to say permission, that's so Pollyanna, but, you know, affirmation.
Incitement.
You're inciting
us. To engage the body in more complex ways and not hide so much. And, you know, certainly I'm one of the beneficiaries of your courage. And then what did you just say? Ode to My Whiteness. So I saw Sharon first read this poem at AWP in Seattle. And it was like an audience of, I don't know, like 5,000 people. It was crazy. And she read this poem and you could feel like the whole wave of the audience go. And I've admired her. That was 4 years ago, I guess, 3 years ago. I've just admired it so much because it's honest. Speaking of as if I could be loyal, right? That's a different kind of family that she's being disloyal to, right? And that's what we need to be. We need to practice disloyalty to these mythologies about race. We need to be disloyal to them at every chance we can get. And for her to say to, you know, and the deep irony is that, of course, it's not an ode. It's so not an ode, right? As if you could be loyal, you know? And to say, yes, I benefit from the fantasy and the imaginary idea of this. And I've done it all my life, and I can't see it. I mean, the part where there's a dream with the hole in the middle, and, you know, can you imagine if more people in the world would admit the ways in which they inhabit privilege, how far we could maybe be. That's not work that anyone can do, but white people can do for themselves. And it's not our job anyway to even think about it, not to mention do it. So the fact that she wrote this poem and that it was in conversation with Evie's poem, you know, Sharon never shies away from difficult material, as we've heard. And so I was just so inspired by it, and I've never forgotten. We all talk about all of Sharon's work, and so that was one of those poems that we were like, did she really do that? Did she really talk about that? And not in some kind of fangirl way, although we fangirl out on her all the time, but here we are again in this conversation, and here she is stepping into it always. She's always on the tip, you know, of the needle, like, okay, here, you know. And it would just be so wonderful if that could happen more. And I think she's also modeling that. You're also modeling that again. So it's just been in my head since the moment I first heard it, way before. I don't even know, were you even writing the Odes book then? I don't think so. Maybe. I don't know. It was like 4 or 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so.
It's remarkable.
Yeah. Well, another thing, though, about that table that you and I were around when Sable Venus was, and these poems were being written and brought in, I was learning from everyone around the table.
Mm-hmm.
The way the old learn from the young is we have everything to learn because there's the whole future we don't know anything about.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been learning from you all along. Yeah.
Well, thank you both for your teaching and your learning.
Thank you.
Questions in the house. There's one.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello, Sharon. Hello, Robin.
Hi.
So, Robin, you had mentioned earlier that you. That when you write poetry, it's at least some of the poems that you were fighting you're fighting yourself, and then also Sharon, you had mentioned, you know, being disloyal. So what do you do when, like, either because of upbringing or cultural, like, what happens if trying to write something and expose something, like, literally feels like death. Sometimes, like I'm gonna write this and paint death, you know, and like and it can be a pretty anxious for some people to try to cover that, like, and so I was just wondering if you've ever felt that way, and if so, like, what have you found to, like, navigate through that?
May I just repeat the question? Have we ever felt anxious writing a poem?
Like, I mean, like, to the point where it's like you're literally going to die. Like, you know, in so many words, I suppose.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think I'm too happy when I'm writing to realize that I'm going to die. I think it's amazing to me that I get to write these words. When I was a kid, I was told that God could read the thoughts in my mind. This was not a nice God. And that's very difficult to live with. That's where my poem in this book, when I finally wrote Ode to Thought, I was so excited because as a child, I'd thought a lot about thought, which you can't control and which I was going to go to hell for. So I think it's intelligent to be anxious when we're trying to write something new. And I wouldn't wish for that. I'm so anxious at all other moments in my life. Oh, I'm glad to have that. So I don't think it's a sign of anything necessarily good or bad. But one might try petting one's cheek while writing, I believe in kissing one's wrist as one would the wrist of a child who's in trouble, because look at us, you know. So that I might, if I could think of taking action for myself against that fear while doing the writing, the energy might move around a little. Yeah. Yeah.
That's great. Hello. I've been taking furious notes on what you're saying, and so I'm curious to see if you could impart, like, 5 people that you're reading currently that are really exciting to you. And go slowly so I can take my notes. Please and thank you.
Would you like 5 from both of them? I mean, how about a joint list?
Sure. I am rereading Hilton Ahl's The Women in Awe. He had his book White Girls come out last year, which was stunningly brilliant. And so I'm rereading White Girls, which came out in 1996, and it's stunningly brilliant. And it's made even more so by the fact that it came out in 1996.
Oh, wow.
It predates. Huh. I mean, you know, sure, it might be a little bit more familiar to certain conversations now. I mean, a little bit, because he's still so far ahead of us by centuries. But the fact that he did it in 1996 just stuns me. So I'm reading that right now. And what else is by my bedside? I just ordered Grimke's book, Rachel, a collection of poems that just arrived. So that's Angelina Grimke. Yeah, so older poems from the 19th century.
Ocean Vuong.
Mm-hmm.
Who's coming in the spring?
Oh, how cool. Oh, how cool.
Another NYUer just saying.
Yes, yes. Amazing good fortune that we've had there. Terrence Hayes, Eileen Miles. Just so.
Yeah. There's so much.
There's so much.
Yeah.
I have one more question.
Thank you. What a beautiful evening.
Thank you.
Robin,
thank
you mentioned that you had a story you wanted to share, and I'm dying to hear it.
Yes! It's perfect. I don't know, maybe because the debate. I don't know. I'm just so sick of sexism right now. I'm done. And if I am done, I know that there's so many other people who are super done. So anyway, I wrote Verga because I was at an artist residency, and I was writing about my father in World War II and kind of performances of masculinity and segregation in World War II. And, you know, you get in the zone, and I have what I've been told by my students, RBF. Is that it, Tisa? Resting bitch face. I'm trying to catch up. I know. I'm trying to catch up with the kids and be hip. RBF, resting bitch face, which is to say, when I'm calm, I look angry. And usually I'm just thinking. Usually I'm just like, yeah, right? And so I come down to dinner, and I had been writing about, World War II all day. And I'm in line to get my dinner at this residency, and this guy turns around and says, why don't you smile? And I was looking at him like, I will kill you right now.
Yes. Yeah.
Do you know, like, but I wasn't, because my dad had died, you know, and had died recently, and I'm writing about war, and I'm reading about, like, the Holocaust and the show. You know, I'm in a state of war and trauma and watching human beings behave very, very badly, as if it's none of his damn business. But anyway. And so I just looked at him, and I just turned on my heel and walked away. And I thought, I know, I'll go look at some art to make myself feel better, because why engage that? And I went, this residency I was on had a magnificent art library, and I went and found, I just sat down, and I opened this book, first book that I chose without even thinking, not even paying attention to it. It was called A Camel for The Sun by, let me just think, Faisal Sheikh. And it's a fantastic text and image book, photography and testimonies, and of refugees in the Dagaheli Somali refugee camp in Kenya in 2000. And it was portraits. And the page I opened to was of this woman, and her testimony was the epigraph that I wrote. Women don't want men to go into the bush because the women will only be raped, but the men will be killed. And I was like, okay, I can't get away from it. Fine. So I sat right there and I wrote that poem in like 10 seconds. I was like, that's it. I'm not even going to try. And this is what women are experiencing in war. And there are lots of different ways in which we engage women violently. One is to say, why don't you smile? And one is to say, one is to tie you to a tree during a war. Yeah. And so I wrote that poem. Mm.
And you know what I so loved when you read it tonight is its beauty. Thank God. Thank you for the beauty of that poem.
Thank you, Sharon.
Thank you both for the beauty.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.